Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Golf Talk Live. I'm your host, Ted Oderico, and it's already into another month, May 1st today. And I don't know where this year is going, but it's going by quick. And of course, here in the northwest part of Florida, we've been getting a lot of rain here the last few days. So I'm very thankful that it seems to have eased up a little bit. I didn't have to jump on the arc this trip. So hopefully the rain is going to be passing through and be gone. But anyways, got a great show for you tonight. We've got another episode of Coach's Corner. And got a great panel I'm going to bring up here in just a minute or two. But I just want to remind everybody, of course, the broadcast is live on blogtalkradio.com from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. I'm going to cut the program a little bit shorter tonight only because my initial guest that was going to be following the panel discussion unfortunately had another engagement tonight, and I didn't have time to get somebody else to follow. So I'm going to just have the panel tonight, and I'm going to talk for a few minutes afterwards myself, and then we're going to close the program for tonight. But anyways, let me bring out the panel on Coach's Corner tonight. And, of course, another great PGA teacher professional from the Montclair Golf Club, Mr. Brian Dobby, is back with us here on Golf Talk Live. And a newcomer to the panel, but she has been a guest on Golf Talk Live in the past, is Penny Pauls, and she's a LPGA professional, a two-time LPGA champion, ranked top 10 golfer in the world with an accomplished 18-year LPGA playing career. And she also, as a coach, has garnered her second top 50 teacher award. Miss Penny Pauls is here with us as well tonight. And, of course, my returning champ, Mr. Clint Wright, the PGA teacher professional from R3 Golf Academy over there on the East Coast, and he's going to be coming on here and sharing, I'm sure, some pearls of wisdom tonight. Penny and gentlemen, welcome to Coach's Corner.
Great to be with you, Ted.
Ted, thanks.
Great
for
to be here.
Okay. I know I discussed with you guys off-air just a minute ago about the topic that we're going to start off tonight, but let me just very quickly here before we start, I just want to remind everybody, for those that are tuning in for the first time tonight, that every Thursday night I start the program. I've started now since March the 6th with a Coach's Corner segment. It's a panel discussion where I'll post some questions that you guys have emailed into the program and hopefully pick the brains of some of the best coaches and teaching professionals in the business. And every week I try to rotate out the panel, and of course some like Clint like to come back, and Brian is, of course, like to come back every so often and pitch in. So I appreciate you guys for doing that. And of course we want to help out some of you weekend warriors out there as well that need some help with the game. So essentially here's how it's going to work. As I said, each week I'll take some questions that have been emailed into me and into the panel, and I will start the discussion, of course, and then rotate around to each of the members of the panel for some general comments, and then open the floor to any additional comments. So this is certainly your opportunity to participate in the discussion. You can certainly call in anytime during the live broadcast at 6 p.m. Central Standard Time, and the number you can call in is area code 646-716-4667, or you can email questions if you want during the live broadcast as well, even though I've selected some for tonight. You can certainly continue to keep emailing them in, and that's to questions.golftalklive@gmail.com. All right, guys, thanks for coming on the panel tonight. And as we discussed off air, here's the topic for tonight. It was sent in by a gentleman by the name of Mark from Scottsdale, Arizona, and here essentially is what he's got to say. He said in his email, "As teacher professionals, you come across all types of students, from the beginners to the more advanced. After years of teaching golfers of all ages and abilities, what, if anything, do you feel you have learned from your students?" And, Clint, I lied. I'm going to throw you under the bus first. Clint, do you want to start that one off?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, after I got this topic, I'm going, you know, that's a really tough question. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, every student brings something unique to you. whether they're a beginner or an advanced player, they come with their own set of challenges and own set of goals. But, you know, I think early in my career, as most of us are, we're always low man on the pole or low lady on the pole, as it may be. And I guess some of the things that I learned the most was patience and persistence from a group of ladies that I had the pleasure of teaching when I was a young teaching professional. It was a Tuesday mornings ladies golf league clinic. And those ladies taught me more about, you know, persistence and, you know, patience, because they were some of the most patient and persistent people I've ever met, because as a 20-year-old teaching professional, I began to question my ability at that time, because, I mean, they had a couple of – it took them a month to get a ball off the ground, you know. And so, you know, I could see where they weren't going to back off as long as I didn't back off. And, so early on in my career, I learned that, no matter how it was going, if that student still showed up for that 10 o'clock lesson, you better put your best game on, because they're there to get better, and they're going to show you that, hey, don't give up on me, because I'm not giving up on you, and just let's stay at it, and with a little patience, we'll get this thing. So I guess early on, that's what I learned the most from that group of students was, you know, some patience and persistence. And I guess I took that into some of my better players' careers down the line to teach them, you're not going to become a tour player overnight.
Right.
It's time. You have to be persistent. And it's strange how sometimes the better players, they don't have that patience and persistence. They want it now.
Right.
You know, and I guess I learned that I try to teach to the other students, knowing that I know those guys don't have that quality about them. So I was, that was the one thing I think once I read this question that dawned on me, that those ladies 30, 40 years ago probably helped my career more than any group of people that I've ever come across to know how to deal with certain different personalities on the practice team.
Excellent. That's a great answer. And I'm going to go next to Penny, if that's all right. Penny, what, if anything, do you feel that you've learned from students that you've worked with over your career?
Well, I've learned everything. I think you learn life's lessons, and I mean, you're with different people every day, so you're learning that you need to have a lot more education on personality styles. You're learning from, as a professional in the coaching world, you know, they're our greatest people to tell us what we know and what we don't know, because we know if we're getting better, if we can get the point across in less words and in a more uniform manner. And I think that's always been my gauge for am I improving as a person who's trying to help someone grow in the game of golf. But the one point that I do know is, having been a tour player, you can't teach someone what it's like to be on tour. You can't expect them to say, you know, it'll just come. I mean, if you haven't experienced something, you can't, you know, you just can't transfer it. And so in the end of the day, the greatest lesson I learned working with lots and lots of tour players is let them fall down. Let them screw up, you know, and then they'll come back ready to learn. And so I always, you know, I used to say, oh, would you hurry up and screw up so that we can really get to learning? I think that'll be much more fun. So that's what those two things I would say.
Some great answer as well, Penny. Thank you. And certainly last but not least, Brian, what do you think that you've learned from your students over the years?
Well, Ted, I'll tell you, I just want to start out by saying thank you to you for having me back on the show. And thanks for throwing Clint under the bus. Because as I listened to his answers, you know, I was jotting some notes down myself, and it's funny, the two words I wrote down was patience and persistence. So, Clint, you know, I love listening to your answers because we're right on cue together, so it's really good. Ted, I'm looking back over my career teaching. It's over 20 years now, and I think from the players, it's everybody's got a different style, and different learning styles, and I think when I was younger teaching, I tried to do it all one way, and I learned through my students over the years that there's no one way, and then everybody has a different way to receive information and how they take the lessons, and it's really opened me up to being more versatile in teaching, because that person, no matter what their ability, has so much passion to learn, and I better give them my passion when I'm teaching. So the one thing is, you know, everybody's different, and you've got to adapt to them during that lesson.
Yep, very well said. Some great answers, guys, and let me just throw in there as well. I agree with you, Brian, and thank you, Brian. I'm glad to have you back, and as I said to all my guests, you know, I enjoy doing this program because it gives me an opportunity to learn as well. I even, believe it or not, I actually even learn from Clint every once in a while. Not too often, but occasionally I get a pearl of wisdom coming out.
I'm happy for you.
I can't think of anyone I would rather give a zinger to every once in a while than you, Clint. So,
I appreciate it. Only amongst friends, man. Only amongst friends.
That's right. But, you know, I agree with you, though, Clint, and Brian as well, and Penny. I think all of those things, you know, we learn over time. But I think certainly patience and persistence are certainly at the very top of my list as well. I think that working with a lot of different types of personalities, you know, Penny, as you had alluded to, you're going to, you know, have to adapt and have to learn how to handle those personalities. And you've got to be, I think the number one thing that it taught me, as I'm sure if anybody's tuned to this program, I'm definitely never lacking in words. I'm a talker, of course, but I've also had to learn to listen. And I think one of the biggest things that a teacher has to be able to do is be an effective listener, because a lot of times, you know, anybody can be a good player if they put enough effort into it, and I don't mean necessarily a tour player, as Penny suggested, but I mean, you can be a good ball striker and you can be a pretty decent player, but not everybody can be a good teacher, and you've got to be somebody that's willing to listen to what the students are asking of you, and if you're not able to do that effectively, then you're not going to be able to articulate what you need to get across. And as Penny had also alluded to, you know, you want to be able to do that in as few words as possible. In other words, you want to be able to direct them in the right direction within a reasonable period of time. And if you're, you know, if you're taking weeks and months to get your point across, then you're not doing your job effectively. So, you know, those are some things that I want to do. And something else that I learned, you know, over the years, I know this is going to be taking a shot at some of the people I've taught, but I always found doctors and lawyers were the cheapest ones for taking golf lessons, and they were the ones that had the most money. But anyways, that was just something I had to throw out there. But, it's true. You know, I mean, come on. But, no, I had really good students. I did a lot of corporate teaching when I was back, especially when I was back home in Canada. I did a lot of teaching with corporate types and that, and it was always fun. I would go to different tournaments that they would have, and I would do some guest spots there, and always enjoyed you know, instructing in front of large groups like that. But then I would also, you know, work with some of them individually afterwards, and always enjoyed that because there was always a different spectrum of golfer. You always had your, you know, your sort of newbies to the game that never really played much, and then you had yours that had, you know, played quite frequently. So there was a broad spectrum of abilities there. So it was always interesting and challenging for me to try and adapt to each of those different personalities. But great answer and great way to start off the program. So thank you very much, Penny and Clint and Brian. Now I'm going to move on to some of the other questions here. This one here is from a gentleman by the name of Charlie from San Diego, California. And he asked really not so much about the game, but he wants clarification on something here. And here's what he wrote. Many professional golfers, and of course he refers to Jack Nicklaus, comes to mind, often say a course does or doesn't fit their eye. And he wants to know what exactly are they talking about. What does it mean? And Brian, I'm going to start off with you this time. What exactly are they talking about when they're saying a course? And Jack has said this many times in his career that certain courses didn't fit his eye. Augusta was one that did. What is he talking about, and how can we apply that to our everyday golfer out there? How can we help them with that?
Well, Ted, I think, you know, any player, you know, you stand on a tee and it might be a dog leg to the right or left, and what they're talking about is the shot shape you tend to play. Sometimes it really fits the hole and you play that hole really well, and other times you get up on the tee box and you don't see how you're going to get the ball down that fairway, and that's what I think Jack Nicklaus is talking about, and I think golf is played with the eyes. You know, you get up over any shot, and the first thing I'll do is I'll see the trajectory or the curve of the ball I want to hit, and that translates into my setup and then how I'm going to deliver the club face and stuff. And I think for any player to start looking more at the target, they're going to start playing with their eye, and then that'll relate to some type of shot they want to hit as opposed to getting up there and just staring at the ball and thinking about mechanics. So I think that's what Charlie was talking about. Some courses fit your eye. They might have more shots to the right or to the left, but you'll typically play better on a course that fits your eye or your shot shape that you're trying to play that day.
Right. Penny, let me just rephrase this just a little bit different, you know, because obviously we don't want to repeat sort of the same answer. But if somebody gets to a course that maybe they're not comfortable on some of the holes because it doesn't really fit in their game, as Brian was talking about, what are some things that they can do to sort of overcome that? What are some adjustments that they can make to do the best they can, in other words, on holes that maybe don't fit quite to their eye?
Right. No, I totally understand that. But I will say anyone who shoots 100 or more, don't even worry about this part of the segment because they're not tuned in to really good alignments, and they wouldn't. And even if they are lined up at where they want to go, they have no sensitivity of the path to their alignment. So I'm going to just preface that for newbies. Just think about it. I like what Brian said. Just look at a target and kind of go, have a sense of going in that direction. But for a more sophisticated player, when I would play in New York, some of the older golf courses where they'd have tees aiming right and fairways going left, and then they'd have these funky-shaped bunkers, what I would call it is geometric alignments, and you can only do this a few times in a round, or you get wacky in the head. But what I would do is a lot of times I would be just like the beginner. I wouldn't be able to fuse where I was aimed with my path. I couldn't get that correlation together. And so I would have to pick out points in front of the ball and behind. And funnily enough, when you can't just have a natural swing, you'll either take it a little edgy on the outside or a little inside. So you maybe not do a turn, or you might slide a little bit off the golf ball because you're uncomfortable. So I would just go through what I call this geometric alignment. And so I would hit my points where I'd want to make sure I'd either have to make sure I have a good shoulder turn, you know, or something like that, so that I could just flow into that position. And that, of course, takes, you know, you have like 10 seconds to hit that golf ball, create, you know, 20 seconds, you create the idea and then develop the idea and then hit the idea. So in the world of focus, if I'm adding an extra piece to put into my routine, well, I can only do that a few times before I go into information overload. So it's very delicate when you're playing a course. And, you know, we didn't have a choice every week. We had to play a different course, and some holes just really screwed with us. So we could just do that for a little bit, and then we'd have to release it and let it go. So there are several tips, and that was one of my most favorites that I used, but, again, very sparingly.
Right. Clint, let me, again, add a further twist for you. you're welcome. you know, let's take as an example somebody that's come to a course and again, you know, maybe is faced with a sharp dog leg left. They're not a very good drawer of the ball. Maybe they fade a little bit or they're able to hit it straight. Obviously, a concern may be running through the fairway. So what are some suggestions that you might make to a player like that that's coming up that's maybe intimidated with that shot because it doesn't fit their eye? Would you, as an example, would you maybe advise them to scale it back instead of pulling out a driver, maybe hit a, you know, a fairway wood or something that's not going to run through the fairway and just, you know, to keep it clear? What would you suggest?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we joke, but there's a whole lot of thinking going on here, you know, which in some cases is, like Penny says, is just going to, you know, take you totally out of where you want to be. But, you know, I guess that the way that some Penny's probably got more tournament experience than I do for sure. But, you know, I think when you go out, you play your practice rounds, you see a golf course, and there's holes that you really feel comfortable on, and there's holes that you don't. And I think that if you look at what a course fits their eye, my opinion would be there's more holes on that golf course that I feel comfortable on than
right.
I don't. Okay? So, therefore, I have to develop a strategy now to play aggressively on the holes that I like and survive the holes that I don't. And that's where the strategy comes down to, you know, I want to be able to just move around this hole that doesn't fit my eye, or I don't like the way this hole plays, or maybe the distance I hit the ball carries it into a slope and it bounces different directions. So if I know that, then I'm definitely going to, instead of hitting that driver that's going to carry me up into the slope where it kicks off in the wrong direction, I may lay the ball back underneath that slope with whatever it takes for me to lay it underneath.
Right.
So there's a definitely on the tour level or accomplished player level, I think the idea of a course that fits my eye is as much about strategy and how you're going to maneuver around this particular course than anything
mm-hmm.
else. So to answer your previous question, well, certainly if that hole doesn't fit their eye, you know, par is a good score.
Yeah.
You know, so let's make a par on this one hole and move on to the next one. That may be, you know, what I feel like is an opportunity for me to be a little more aggressive. And, you know, Penny can tell you is that the best players on tour, they just don't give birdies back.
Right.
You know, they just don't
right.
give them back. So they take the birdies on the holes they feel comfortable with, and they don't give them back on the holes that they don't, and they play to a strategy level that says, how can I easily make a par here? That's all I want on this hole. Make a good par, move on to the next opportunity. So, yeah,
right.
I tell them,
Jack,
don't hold back.
Yeah, and Jack Nicklaus talked about that, you know, many times through his career. You know, I often heard him when he was with the announcers, and they would ask him, you know, about a specific course or a specific hole, and that's pretty much the answer he would give as well. Is, you know, he was happy just to get away with the par there, and not, you know, lose ground on a tournament. And I think that that's a smart way to play it. And I think a lot of people get up there and, you know, get on a hole that they're not comfortable with and figure that, you know, they can maneuver their way around. And sometimes that's not always the best, you know, way to approach it. And if they go there with the mindset of, you know, if I can just make par here, then I'm going to get onto the next hole, which maybe does fit my eye a little bit better. And if something, you know, through a miracle happens that they do better than par, well, that's a bonus. But don't try don't try to chew off more than you know, or bite off more than you can chew, rather.
Right.
You know, the one thing that I think that is probably, in my opinion, if not the number one killer, and Penny, you chime in here specifically because I know you've played a lot of tour events, Matt. I think that for the amateur golfer particularly, I think they try to overthink too much on the golf course, and more often than not, that gets them into trouble. Do you agree with that? Do you think that that's something that a lot of amateurs do when they're playing, is that they get too many thoughts going in their head, and you know, whether on a hole or they're thinking too far ahead in the round, and it just sort of boggles their mind down? Did you find that with some of your experiences as well?
Well, I think it doesn't matter if you're an amateur or pro. I think we all suffer from that. But the difference really is we get trained somewhat to manage our focus. And that's what I've been spending the last 25 years to understand, how we can manage our focus on demand under the heater, because we think differently under the heater. But it's much of an art form. And once you understand the fundamentals of focus, and as we progress in understanding these areas, then we can manage the game just like we manage a golf swing. There's no difference managing the focus as it is. But the big thing that I was listening for and appreciated Clint on his comments was what I took from what he was saying was, know how good you are. How are you playing today? And that will determine. So if you come to a call and, you know, you watch players, we'll shoot 64 and go and shoot 80 the next day because we're still shooting 64.
Yeah.
So I think that the humility of being a golfer is that every day it's a new day, and every day
yep.
our brain is different. And so having the humility to say, okay, I'm bloody nervous, right? So I might be a bit brain stupid today. So what can I do with what I have? Not worrying about my swing is running away. And like, and I think, I suppose, and I'll round this up quickly, is that I think amateurs worry more about their swing than tour players, unless a tour player is in a slump, then it's the opposite.
Right.
But normally, you know, a swing is a swing. It's keeping ourselves organized to be in the moment to say, you know, I don't feel good. I don't feel good over this shot, so what can I do? As Clint says, what can I do? I see the shot that I should be able to hit, but I can't do it right now. And I think that's the, and that is true for an amateur and a pro, but I think as pros, because we've done so many stupid things, we're quicker to say, you know, I got to take that ego and get it out of here and see what I can scrape onto the green.
Yeah. Yep. Well,
yeah.
Well,
I mean, that's
so.
That's the gospel ahead. Right there.
Yeah, that's so true. Very well said, Penny. I'm gonna skip this next question here because I want to get on to one more. And obviously, this question I'm skipping is the one about Tiger. We are going to get back to that, but I want to pass this one for just a moment, and then we'll get back to that one. And this next question here, unless anybody had any other further thoughts they wanted to add to the last one before I move on, is that okay, or is everybody satisfied with what's been said?
I'm good to go.
Ted, okay. I'd like to add one thing in. You know, I try to teach my students this one question is, what's the par from here? And on holes that might not fit your eye or whatever, you hit a tee shot, you know, ask yourself that question. What's the par from here? Is it a par three or a par four? And give yourself two putts, and it kind of gets you back into the moment and seeing the hole played out another way. And hopefully you can get through that hole with a par or a bogey and no big numbers. But just staying in the moment can really get you over those hurdles on the golf course sometime with that one question.
Right. Very good point. And thank you for adding that in. On this next question, I'm going to let Brian, I'm going to let you start off on this one here. Let me just quickly read it here. This is from Joan from Newport, Rhode Island. And starts off, thank you for taking my question. I played for a few years now with some friends and fellow coworkers in our company tournaments. I play weekly, about a 25 handicap. My goal is, of course, to shoot lower scores, obviously. But after trying several things, she doesn't get specific, but trying different things, I don't seem to be able to budget very much. So in other words, her handicap isn't moving very much. I think one problem is, she indicates that she doesn't hit it far enough, but I'm sure there are many other areas I can improve on. Now, we've kind of had a similar question to this before, but I think it's you know, worth bringing again, and especially, you know, Penny, I want you to chime in here, obviously, as well in a moment. But her principal question is, what are some areas of her game that she can work on that will help her to improve? So in other words, she's gone out, she's tried different things, but nothing seems to be helping her. Now, she doesn't indicate where she's, you know, whether she's taking lessons or not. But Brian, if you had a student that's come to you with this question, how would you address it? How would you handle her?
Ted, that's a great question. You know, we see that all the time with our students. But the first thing that comes to mind is I want to know how her game is from, say, 75 yards and in. And I think golf is like a 100-yard and in game. You know, we tend to hit two shots, 200, 300, 400 yards, and then what do you do from there? So I'd ask Joan to hit some shots for me, see how her wedge game is, see how her bunker play is, and maybe we can save her a few shots by helping her putting a little bit, maybe her chip shots a little bit, and some wedge shots. And I think a 25 handicapper could be a 15 handicapper with a little bit more work inside that 100-yard marker, really. I would start right there, Ted.
Yeah, good point. Penny, from your perspective, because I'm sure, you know, as we all have, we've seen this scenario many, many times, but if you've got somebody that's come to you with this sort of a scenario, which again, we've all seen many times, what are some of the things that you want to first look at, and then where do you want to try and steer her, if possible?
Right. And I would also put this to senior golfers, too. I mean, once you lose distance. There's two things. I was at the PGA show in January, and they had these amazing speakers up on the appropriate length of golf courses for women, of which they're all too darn long. So that's the first thing. And they're certainly, in the world of golf, are starting to look at those issues so that more women can actually play par golf. So that would be number one. The majority of courses for women are too long, considering they only hit the driver about 120 yards, the majority of women. So that kind of gives us all a ballpark. And I do like what Brian said, to work on the short game. But more importantly, I would ask, how much time do you spend? Because women, as women, we have family, commitments, and all those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And plus, how much athletics has she played? Because athletics, I train a lot of women just on athletics before we even really get into a golf game. So once I know those questions, then we'll see how much time management and all of those issues, family life, all that stuff that we do as wonderful women. And then we can see, you know, what would make you happy? What would make it happier for you for a game of golf? I know you're supposed to get the score down low, but, you know, if you're only hitting five or six greens, maybe we can make it a game in regulation. Maybe we can make the game a different way for you to look at it. So I think maybe changing the mindset would be massive, as well as your traditional thinking of, as Brian said, of course, going from 100 yards in.
Yeah, I like that. In fact, I'm gonna write that one down myself. I like that answer. Thank you, Penny. Clint, any thoughts you want to add to this question as well for Joan?
Sure. I think Penny is very much onto it. If you look at it, women, let's take the average male player versus the average lady player. And one thing I would recommend to her is to try to determine, you know, if she's not hitting it far enough, she needs to, you know, go through the things we talked about before, good physical fitness program, you know, get a few lessons, see if we can pick up some club head speed, the general answers. But to follow up on what Penny's line was, is you take the average man out there playing on a, you know, your normal 380-yard par four, he's going to hit a driver, maybe a 6-iron, driver and a 5-iron. Now, he may not get it on the green, but he can probably hit it far enough to get it in the cylinder or around the green area. You take the average lady, they can't get the ball on a par four to the green in two shots, period. I mean, so if you look at it, it's really not a par four for the average lady.
Right.
So it's probably more like a par five. If the average man can hit that ball 380 yards in two shots, regardless of what gets on the green, they can make it go that distance. And the lady is sitting back there at, let's say, 300 yards. They're not going to be, a lot of them can't get it that far. So we do need to analyze where we have the ladies. You know, historically the ladies' tee boxes are just on front of the men's tee boxes.
Right.
You know, we really want you to play, but you're going to play back here. We're not going to build any tee boxes for you. You know, so some of the modern courses today obviously are recognizing with the 4 and 5 and sometimes 6 tee boxes that they have different players. I always recommend to anybody I'm teaching, if you can't get it the distance, move up a tee.
Yep.
Find the distance that you're going to be able to hit that tee shot and then a mid-iron to the green. That's what you're looking for. Then she can determine what her par is. You know, if she's a 25 handicapper right now, if she can't get the ball up around the green in two shots on par fours and three shots on par fives, she's got to reevaluate what her real par is.
Yeah.
And it could be that – She's playing par fours, par fives, and par sixes.
Yeah.
You know? So if she starts analyzing her score and her handicap based on that level of numbers, she's probably not doing all that bad. It's just a pure physical issue to get the ball to go further where she can, or to start playing the course from a shorter area. So that is kind of a complex question and a complex answer from all of us. But I think that you look at it specifically for her, she needs to maybe evaluate where she's at as far as strength. But as the game in general, I agree with Penny, we need to start playing. You know, one of the greatest things I've ever seen on a golf course is the USA kids, you know, the tee markers up there at the 150.
Yeah.
You know, and they're playing the same game as mom and dad's playing now.
Yeah, you know, exactly.
They're hitting that drive, hitting that iron on the green, and two-putting and making a par. And that's a whole lot more fun.
Yeah, I think, you know, and, you know, Penny raised a really good point about the athletic part of it. I think this is where, you know, the average woman out there playing certainly lack in some area that their, you know, their fitness is not, you know, is hindering them somewhat. And I think if they get into a more athletic, you know, what's the word I'm looking for, shape, if you will, I think that they're going to find that their distance is going to improve, and that's certainly going to help them. But in the meantime, there's a lot of things.
Well, one thing, though, that we should remember is our muscle tissues and everything are much smaller. So that being
right.
said, a senior and a guy who worked out would incrementally go from 380 to 40 more yards. A woman hitting it at 120 and 130, incrementally moving it by 25 yards, because we only have 10 yards differences between our irons. So that you're still in the same ballpark. We still come back to it's not so much a woman needs to work out more, because a guy, then you could say to the guys, really the question is as we look at the global idea of golf and why women are still staying stagnant at 20%, is because we're not making the game fair in many ways to women, and we're still blaming them to say, oh, go and work out more. But we don't say that to a guy and say, oh, go and work out more. So I think it's a delicate issue. And I think it's one, and I appreciate the guys talking about it. Like, it's fun to say to the juniors, it's okay for the juniors to play up at that tee, and everyone feels good about it. Well, we want to get to the place of the same as women. We want to honor the women and say, hey, this is your tee. And I think that's where we're trying to get to. We want to be able to honor our children. We want to honor our wives, our husbands, our grandparents, and play the appropriate tees for their physicalness.
Right. That's a very valid point. And you're right. And I don't, you know, I would suggest that women necessarily need to go out and work out. I just think that certainly can help, you know, a little bit, but it's certainly not going to, you know, resolve all of the issues. You're right that the industry itself has to take a look at thing, and golf course designs have to be more, you know, friendly to all players of all levels and of all abilities. And, you know, certainly some of the more modern courses do are starting to incorporate that with several sets of tees. And I think programs like Tee It Forward that is being pushed in the industry now, I think is a smart move as well. And you know, it's not even just the ladies. There's a lot of amateur golfers out there, men particularly, who still have that ego, you know, flapping around there in between their ears, thinking that they're going to hit from the championship tees. And, you know, they're lucky if they can even see the green in two shots. And for some reason, they just feel, if I'm going to pay X number of dollars, I'm going to get, you know, all 7,600 yards. I'm going to walk every, you know, all 7,600 yards. And they, you know, I don't understand that sometimes. And you know, as Clint had alluded to as well, you know, move it up a set of tees if need be. If you're not, you know, making very many pars on the course, well, then move up. And, you know, and play until you get comfortable there. And then, you know, if you want to move back at some point, if you feel that that's not challenging, then you can always move back. But to start way at the very back of the tee box, for especially a new player, all it's going to do, and I think that happens with a lot of women too. Women are, you know, I'll give them credit. They're much smarter about it, I think, than men are, and more realistic. But I think, you know, if they can move it up a little bit as well, if it's going to help their game initially, and then certainly work on, as Brian indicated, work on the short game, which I think women tend to do anyways more effectively, in my opinion, than a lot of men do. But a great way, and I'm to answer the questions, everybody, and thank you. And Joan, if you're tuning into the program here now or later on, I hope we answered your question. I'm going to go back to question number two. This one here is about Tiger Woods. This has been actually circulated around really through the media. This question you'll understand in a second here for quite some time, but I thought, you know, I wanted to pose it to the panel here tonight, and I'm going to read the email from Tom from Philadelphia, and this is what he has to say, and then I'll put how he phrased his question. He says, I've watched Tiger Woods play since he first stepped out on tour back in 1997. In the beginning, from 97 to 2004, he worked with his then coach Butch Harmon, had great success. He then changed to Hank Haney from 2004 to 2010. also had great success. And finally, he had changed once again to another coach, Sean Foley, in 2010 to present. He's enjoyed some success, of course, with Sean as well, but has fallen short from what he has done in the past. With each coach, Tiger has undergone several swing changes. I understand that all golfers want to improve, but I've also heard many say that you will never find that perfect game. You're always in pursuit of it. With that in mind, his question, he says, is simple. Were all the swing changes necessary? If so, why? So really what he's asking, and I'm going to, Penny, I'm going to, as I alluded to earlier to Clint, I'm going to throw you under the bus here first, only because I know you've had a lot of tour experience. Forgive me. Don't hate me. But you've had a lot of tour experience. And this is not, you know, I don't want to, you know, make any illusions that this is an attack on Tiger or anything for what he's done. But try to explain, if you can, from a tour player's perspective, why some players out there feel it necessary to go through that kind of a drastic change every time.
Right. Well, I have read in Tiger's, every player goes through changes for different reasons. There's no one pat answer, so I'm just saying that up front. And just from my own reading, I read several years ago, and guys, you might have read this too, is that Tiger gets bored easily. So for him to go on another mission, and he's a mission guy, so for him to change his swing gives him a refocus, and it's a creative process, and it gets him inquisitive again and keeps him in the game and keeps him hungry. And I think there is something in there because he's such a killer. You know, he needs that. He needs something there. So I think my opinion for that, just from that snippet years ago, is probably to keep him fresh mentally so he doesn't get bored. Because I'll tell you, golf is flat out boring after you've been on tour 10 years. It's flat out boring, and you've got to come up with some very inventive ways about making this swing the most dynamic thing I've ever done in my bloody life, and I'm so excited to hit it this moment because that's what golf requires. It requires you to be like a kid, and a kid is, you know, like a little kid. I'm so excited, Mommy and Daddy, I want to do this right now, and they pull out the very best of themselves. And so then as professionals, we learn how to professionally bring that peak performance moment up whenever we need it so we feel that everything is out of it. Nothing else is as important as this moment. But that's really hard to do after a while. So I think that's one reason why some people will change. And very quickly, the other reason is fear. Because we do lose, and I like what the young man said, we do lose the idea that we are human. So therefore, we become perfectionists. And I've watched players, I'll never forget this one guy, he lost a player from the U.S. Open years ago, and I could tell right away, he's one of those guys that he was a worker, and everyone says, you got to work, 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 work. But if you work in fear, then you're going to push beyond what you are capable of doing. And so then you're going to go and reach out your hand to some snake oil person who comes along, you call them bottom feeders on tour, hey, I got the latest thing, and you're just open and feeling bad, and you go do that. And that's the other kind of reason why a person will change gears. And they can't find an answer to themselves. And really, and I'll finish with this, in the end of the day, no one on the outside can determine why a person does whatever. But on the inside, I will tell you, I've done it both ways. In the end of the day, I've lost my confidence, I've become fearful, and I'm looking for outside answers that I should be answering for myself. So that's kind of like an overview of long or short, and I believe being a tour player.
that's a great answer, and you certainly covered a lot in that. Clint, let me flip over to you, and then Brian, I'll finish off with you.
Okay.
Let's again add a little bit of different dynamic to it. And I agree. I remember Penny as well hearing that Tiger did reference the fact that some, you know, he gets bored very easily and likes to kind of keep it mixed up a little bit, but. You know, Penny raised some valid points. Do you think that with some of the players, do you think it's a pursuit of you know, a perfection in some ways, or do you think it's just they're trying to sort of reinvent themselves, much like pop stars do? They want to reinvent themselves in hoping to resurrect a slump or something like that. Do you think there's that in there as well, or what's your take on it? Why do you think that Tiger has?
I don't think that there's any doubt in that. I think the guys and the ladies that are out there playing this game professionally, they know there's not perfect. Okay, they understand that, and so I do believe if they don't understand that, they're fooling themselves, and that's why they're where they're at. And
right,
you know, I think that is probably true. We all need a little project, you know. I doubt very seriously whether I'm playing the same way I did when I was 30 or 40 or 20. We all change, and I think that's part of Tiger's issues. You know, mm-hmm. You go back and you look at Tiger when he first came on tour, he was a young, lanky guy. He's not
yep.
young and lanky anymore.
No.
So he's maturing, and with a body change and just pure maturity and you know, we all got sore joints, and, you know, obviously it's well documented he's having some back and knee issues. I mean, you can't swing
yep.
the same way. I mean, you have to make adjustments. If you intend to play this game, and we encourage even our amateur players as they mature and get older, you know, to try to look for the best way they can play now. And I think you see that on tour. I mean, and I get a big kick out of what Penny called them bottom feeders. I read and see things all the time, and, you know, hit it straight every time. Add 30 yards to your game. You know, I get a big kick out of those guys because you know all they're doing is selling snake oil.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
because if there was a method you could hit it straight every time, every guy on tour would look the same. You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the answer, like, if you don't know Tiger Woods personally, which I do not,
right.
is simply an opinion. And I think it's evolved around a number of things, both physical. I don't think
yep.
Tiger, you know, I know some of the sportscasters got in a little trouble about talking about Tiger's lost the swagger, you know.
Yeah.
Well, Jack Nicklaus lost the swagger, too, when Johnny Miller and Weisskopf and those guys come along.
Sure.
You know?
Well,
know, so.
And it's also, yeah, and it's also, too, I remember back, you know, when, what was his name, Hal Sutton.
Yeah.
Made a comment some years ago along that line that, you know, that he was playing against Tiger in one of the tournaments and before he sort of retired off into the sunset. And, you know, he made something to the effect that, you know, Tiger is human like the rest of us and he can be beat. And sure enough, you know, he was able to beat him.
Right.
And I think once the other players realized that you know he was human, I think that you know Tiger had a very strong mental game, certainly had the physical ability as well, but he like Jack Nicklaus, you know, Nicklaus had certainly a decent game, but by compared to other players on the tour at his time and even in today's standards, Jack Nicklaus certainly didn't have the best swing on tour. He certainly wasn't the best ball striker on tour. But he had a strong mental capacity, and I know you don't like to use the word mental
no,
game
in
per se.
In this case, it is mental. In that case, it is.
You know, but that's how he's phrased it over the years. And I think that was able to think his way, as it was said earlier, around the course so effectively.
Correct.
That when he was able to, he was able to recover when he did hit a bad shot. So well, much as Tiger has done over the years. And I think, you know, Tiger's just, in a whole different era now. There's just so much more competition that's come up through the ranks with some of the younger guys and injuries and things like that. Brian, I want to jump you into the conversation as well. If Tiger, and as some of the others that Penny had indicated, that there are others that have done it as well, but I think there's also, an area where sometimes, and Nick Faldo comes to mind, where, he was a bit of a perfectionist. I think sometimes there are those out there that are just searching for that perfect game and trying to get their swing so tight. Do you think sometimes it works against some players when they do make too many changes like that?
Ted, you know, looking over the years, you can probably think of, you know, a handful of players that they tinkered around too much and they lost their ability to perform at the level they were. You know, take, for instance, a guy like Ian Baker Finch. You know, he just came off a British Open win, and from what I heard, people were saying he didn't have the length and stuff to play at that level on the PGA Tour, and he started chasing that, and there's a situation where it hurts. So it can go both ways. But back to Tiger, I think he's probably just been programmed like all of us from an early age to try to get better. And with his changes from Butch to Haney to Foley, you know, somewhere along the line he was trying to say, hey, let me try something else. I want to get better. I want to keep improving my game. And what happens, it just evolves. You know, it's easier to look back now on his career and say, why do you do this? Was it necessary? In Tiger's mind, it was necessary, and that's all that matters.
Right.
Like anybody else trying to get better, and if you felt more comfortable or time to move on from Butch and Hank, that's just the way it was. Another thing, just listening to Penny and Clint, I tell you what, I'm learning more just listening to them. This is unbelievable. Getting their feedback, being on the show,
well,
but I also love your guests. It's great.
You know,
well,
Ted, you brought up a good point just a minute ago, and throw something out here about Nicklaus not being the best ball striker, maybe not the best swing. You think about the way Tiger played when he was in his, you know, he hit it all over the golf course. You know, he just was the best player out there. He wasn't the best hitter. And neither was Nicklaus the best hitter, but he was the best player. And so I wonder if Tiger lost a little focus on being a player and was trying to become a better hitter.
I'm right there with you, Clint. I think that's really wise. Amy Alcott was an amazing player. I played with her in the U.S. Open when she went on to win it. Man, that girl could draw it, fade it, everything. She was a player, and she always stayed a player. But I think you're right there. I think maybe he got away from his original. He's been a consummate player, so that's really wise. Not bad for a guy down there.
Yeah, I agree.
No. Well, and that's true. That's a valid point, you know, because and really what I was trying to say was there's, you know, when you think of a lot of the ball strikers on the tour over the years, both male and female, certainly they've won their fair share, but they weren't all necessarily the best players on tour.
Right.
You know, and you look at somebody, you know, even though he was a little of both, but you look at somebody like Lee Trevino, who had one of the, in my opinion, one of the kookiest looking swings imaginable, but it worked for him, and he was able to become a very could hit some great shots when needed, but he was a better player than he was a ball striker in respect to when if you compare it to somebody like Ben Hogan, who was, you know, straight and long and so forth, and compared to some of the other ones. And, you know, Nick Faldo was a little of both. Nick Faldo was, in his very early in his career, was not a very good ball striker, was not a very good player, and as a result sort of revamped his entire swing and he went, as Penny suggested, I think he kind of went a little overboard with trying to make it perfect, that it actually worked against him at some point. He forgot to be a good player, and, you know, now he's in the announcer's booth, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. But I think Nick could have had a few more seasons had he not been the pursuit of the end-all, be-all of the perfect swing, because it really does not exist.
I've been watching Michelle Wee we all have watched Michelle Wee grow up. But I was out at the LPGA tournament out here in town in Phoenix, and I was watching her practice. I've really kept an eye on her. Her whole putting routine has totally changed. She's gone from mechanical. She takes one ball on the green. She gets a sense of her pacing, and then she putted it. And I watched it, and it was like night and day. And if you watch her play now, she is definitely becoming a player, and that's the difference. And I think that's really neat for young gals and guys to see that if we can get away, you know, because we've had so much structure being taught in the last few years about how to swing a club, but now if we can observe some of the great players of the game today and talk more about playing the game and watching how Michelle Wee is truly transforming herself into a player. So I'm excited for her, future. Mm-hmm. And I and that was exciting to me. So I don't know if you guys have kept up on some of the other players that you've seen metamorphosize into players.
Guys, anybody want to?
Well, you know,
you want to repeat?
Yeah, Penny, I didn't quite catch that.
Yeah, I was saying that for Michelle Wee, I've watched her metamorphosize into becoming a player, and it's such a delight to see her, seeing her discover what shot she wants to play, and then just feeling it and then hitting it, and watching her routines, how she practices. It's all about. It's all about playing the game, not trying to figure out how to play the game. She's got to the point of just play the game. And I was asking, have you noticed any of the guys transitioning into becoming players?
Oh, I think the keynote speaker in that's Matt Kuchar.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I mean, he is definitely the keynote speaker on the PGA Tour for becoming a player. I mean, my goodness, look at his golf swing.
Yeah.
Okay, he's the consummate player on tour today, and look where he's at on this season. I mean, he's been in the top 10. He's a perennial top 10 finisher this year, and
yep.
He's become a player. He reminds me so much, Ted, you brought up Lee Trevino. He reminds me a lot of Lee Trevino. You know, hits it downrange, chips and putts.
Yep.
Whatever presents itself, he figures out how to make it work. And I think if I was going to put one up there, he'd be the guy.
Let me just expand a little bit differently, or take the question a little bit differently here. And Brian, I'm going to start with you on this. Do you think that one of the problems on tour nowadays with some of the young, maybe not so much today, but let's say in the last 10 years? That there's been too much focus on swing mechanics and sort of creating that perfect swing, if you will, in order to become a better player as opposed to being a better player. In other words, they're focusing more on, you know, hitting the golf ball perfectly or as close to perfect as they can, as opposed to being, as Penny said, where a lot of the players are now sort of morphing into as Michelle, because I think Michelle Wee was very much like that when she first came out. It was very... you know, mechanical, very, not fluid and that sort of thing. And now she seems to have come into her own. Do you think that a lot of the younger tour players have focused too much on their mechanics and not enough about, you know, as becoming a better player? Brian, I'm going to start with you.
Ted, I'm going to agree with that. And not only tour players, just the amateurs that play the game, this perfection of trying to swing a certain way or a certain style over the last 10 years is predominant. And you take a guy like Bubba Watson out there now that's nobody ever talks about his swing, and I don't think anybody will ever break it down. There's a guy that's just a player. He learned how to curve the ball, hit it long or whatever, and I think there's a guy more people should start modeling. Just go out with what you have and learn to get the ball in the hole. You probably have a lot more fun. You probably spend a lot less time on the range trying to perfect something that you probably can't perfect, and you get more enjoyment out of the game. So to answer your question, sure. I think too many people are trying to hit it perfect every time, and that's just not the reality of the game. You know, golf's a game of misses, and then you have to chip and putt, get in the hole.
Right. Penny, would you agree that maybe what the average golfer, and we'll step away from the tour here for a minute, do you think that maybe the average golfer needs to, and that doesn't mean that there can't be room for improvement along the way, but needs to take the game that they have in the moment and do the best they can to make it work in that given situation, rather than trying to rebuild and restructure and so on? Do you think that maybe more time should be playing the game and working along the way and improving, but not so much on being perfect in trying to hit the ball? In other words, less thought on swing mechanics and more on just playing the game. Do you think more amateurs need to step up and do that?
Well, I think of course what the guys are saying here is I think we need to educate them better. I think, I get around so many amazing coaches and trainers today, and we always talk about this subject, don't we? And it's about getting them on the golf course. But it's also giving them the strategies and tactics of thinking as a player. No one really talks mm-hmm. about that. What's the process of being a player mentally? And it's a, and there's a system there that we use as players. It's a system of mental game, and that's what I train all day long. And so it's the same thing. And so that you can get in the flow. So you get into that intuitive side of you. But, you know, we train today in fear. We teach them to be, oh, you're no good. You don't know this. You don't know that, da-da-da-da. So you're training people to be in fear in golf. But if we just go out and we do all the positive things, as all great coaches do, what do you got? Hey, I like that part. Let's see if we can advance that. That is the tool to then teach them the mental mechanics of how to be a player. And that's what's been missing, because we've been enamored by the gadgets, the widgets. And
yeah.
widgets
oh.
don't keep us going. So it's going to be, and that's a great thing for us as coaches, whether we teach the mental side, whether we teach the physical side, that the people are going to come back to the people, because it's a human sport. And so that our coaches and teachers will get back and have more clients again, because these widgets aren't getting them to lower the score. It's that personal touch. It's that, like we were talking earlier about going out and playing a few holes, talking about one funky little thing that opens them up to the possibility of their own becoming, owning their own power of becoming their own coach, their own player of the game of golf. That's kind of how I see it.
Right, and Clint, I'm going to bring you back on here as well. And you know, Penny raises a great point here about the gadgets, Matt. Penny, I was also – well, actually, you saw me briefly down at the PGA show this year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I saw a lot of – and I'm not going to get into specifics, but I saw a lot of things, a lot of similar things that I've seen for many years and a lot of the same promises. And I've said this very openly on this program you know, where, you know, I use a lot of the equipment particularly. You know, I like some of the equipment that's out there. I think it's fantastic. I think it looks great. But, again, you know, Clint, as you had alluded to, you know, a lot of these promises of hitting it straight every time and
yeah.
30 extra yards every time is, let's be honest, that's a snake oil salesman on steroids, because it's just not true. It's not
right.
going to happen. You know, even the tour players, even the best players, don't necessarily get that full benefit. They're certainly going to get more than the average person. But what, in your estimation, do we need as people in the teaching side of golf?
Mm-hmm.
What do we need to focus on, I think, more with our students in helping them to understand, as Penny had talked about, playing the game and understanding sort of the mental scope of things? What do we need to do differently that maybe, and not saying nobody here is doing it now, but as,
right.
as a general rule throughout the industry, what do we need to start doing more effectively, do you think, to help
a number of things. I'd make a quick comment, and I'll come back to that real quickly, is that, you know, if you look in here, the first law in the R3 approach to play is to take what
mm-hmm.
you have and make it work.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that's the first law. And then if you don't like what's happening on the golf course, go back to the practice team, work on it, and try to get better the next time you go out to play. You know, we break it down into the what axis and the how axis. The what's how you're hitting it, and the how's how you play. And
mm-hmm.
so it all comes down to a number of things, like the gadgets. You know, years ago I used to have a sports tech swing analyzer. You had to have a truck to haul it in, okay? It was so big. Now if I've got a cell phone and a pair of pants on, I can carry that in my pocket.
Yep.
And it frees up everybody on the practice tee to be their own gadget guru. Now,
mm-hmm.
and I get so upset with some people that says, well, put me on the golf tech and let's figure out what it's doing, and they try to make the number come out right.
Yeah.
And what I try to do is to tell them, let's find out what your number is and know how we create that, and then maybe we can use this as a diagnostic tool versus a testing tool.
Right.
So many people use those things to test their ability against somebody. I don't know who it is, but to somebody. But diagnostic tools is one thing. But back to your question about how we begin to teach people how to play golf, well, you don't teach them how to play golf on the practice tee. That's for practice.
Right.
You don't teach them how to putt on the putting green. That's for practice. You know, and I know that there's time-sensitive issues here where we're making a living trying to teach people how to be good players, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what
right.
we're here. And we'll make you a good player. Well, we spend a lot of our time, because a lot of times our students want this now. We spend a lot of time teaching people how to be hitters because we only see them on the practice tee and on the practice putting green. That's the only place we see them.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
if I was, you know, the guys that I work with every day are some of the best I've ever seen at it, is that they take their students on the golf course religiously.
Right.
They take them out. Let's play a few holes. And they'll play two or three holes with them. Now, I understand that at a lot of facilities you don't have that luxury of taking your student out to the first tee and playing two or three holes because there's tee times, there's other people playing. You know, there are mm-hmm. issues there. Okay, I understand that. That's why I really like, you know, to see a golf course, particularly if it's into teaching golf and attracting players, to have that one or two-hole, three-hole practice facility. And I know those are expensive to build, but it's a great way to build players because if you can teach them how to play on those area there, they're going to play the regular course a whole lot more often and want to be good members and good supporters of your facility.
Yeah.
So the only thing I can say, you got to get them out. If you're going to teach them how to play, you got to play with them. You got to get them out there. And that takes time. Instead of being an hour lesson, it's an hour and a half or 2 hours. And I know that takes, mm-hmm. you know, another student's time maybe, but it's definitely worthwhile. And I've seen the guys that I've worked with over the years that have students that have been with them for years coming back continually, not to become better hitters, but they come mm-hmm. out to learn how to play. And they've become better
yeah.
players because of that. So get them on the course. It's the only place you learn how to play.
Yeah, and that's a valid, you know, a valid point as well, and I think that's so true. I mean, there's only really so much that you can teach them on the practice tee or on the putting green, and you know, you really can't teach them how to play the game because you can't, you know, you can certainly imagine a bunch of different scenarios, and that's great for practice, but until you, you know, it's kind of like, I think we talked about this once before, but you know, it's kind of like trying to take your range game out to the golf course. Well, you can't really do it because the range is set up a certain way and your golf course is set up a certain way. And, you know, never the twain shall meet. So, you know, until somebody takes – now, you know, the practice time, that's what the practice tee and the putting green are for. But you need to be out on the course. And you're right, it is very difficult. And I think that the industry is starting to try to be creative and find ways – of doing what you're suggesting, Clint, and I think it's a great idea, and I think that the industry as a whole needs to spend more time helping people and teaching them learning how to play the game and less time on how to build this perfect, you know, monster, if you will, of a, you know, a robo-golfer, because it just, yeah, it just doesn't exist. It's never
going to
happen.
One other
the best of the best.
You know, one other thing I would really love to see people that are into the practice facility arenas. And Penny and Brian, you may have seen this, but I've never seen it, to where there was actually uphill and downhill and side hill lies on the practice tee. They're always flat.
Yep.
Okay? And how many flat lies you got on the course? Not that many.
Yeah, not very. No.
Yeah. You know, always it tickles me. You go to a golf course that's got bunkers on the golf course and don't have a practice bunker on around the practice green.
Yep.
You know,
yeah, there's a lot of them. Well, and even in situations where you do have some of that, you know, here's what I always do when I go up and practice. I practice at a course that's really not in my immediate area. My girlfriend lives a few miles away, so it's up by her way. But they have a multi-tiered teeing area. And what I a lot of times will do is I'll go to the very far end and I will stand on the downslope,
mm-hmm.
Even though technically it's a little further back than what they want me to. And I'll make sure nobody else is around, of course, that
right.
I'm going to be worried about hitting anybody. But I will actually practice, and conversely, you know, if I can find myself an uphill or side hill slope as well, I'll go outside of the teeing area and do that and hit some shots like that, because that
mm-hmm.
helps me practice realistic shots, because you're right. If you're
certainly.
Hitting from a flat lie every single time and off a tee every
right.
single time, you know, that's great for your tee shots, but that's not helping the rest of your game. And I often see a lot of times, you know, around the practice greens, even when there are bunkers, you know, I'll see a lot of golf balls in there, but I don't see anybody in there practicing. The odd person, but the majority of people, no. And then they wonder why their bunker game stinks and, you know, why they can't hit these, you know, awkward stances. So, great comments, guys. I appreciate that. Penny as well for the insight. Let me go. I've got one more question here. This is from Dale. This is a little bit more of a specific to a shot. Dale from Savannah, Georgia, and he says here in his email, I think every golfer has been faced with a situation many times, hitting your drive into somebody else's divot. People should be courteous and, of course, fill their divots. That's his comment, but we'll leave that topic for another discussion. He says, if you're unlucky enough to find yourself in a situation, what is the best or proper way to hit this shot? Penny, I'm gonna, as the resident tour expert here, I'm going to let you start off, ladies first sort of thing. Dale's referring to, obviously, out in the middle of the fairway somewhere.
You're killing me.
Oh, I know. Well, come on. I'm pushing you under that. That's right. We got an equal opportunity for the ladies. So you're fair. That's right. So here Dale's hit a great tee shot, and only to find that when he gets up there that his ball's landed smack dab in the middle of Clint's divot that he forgot to repair. So how are we going to help Dale here?
Dale, suck it up, buddy. Suck it up. That's golf for you. Okay, I remember Debbie Massey on the 72nd hole of the U.S. Open hit it in the divot. That's golf. You know, whatever the lie is, figure it out. That's where real, but seriously, and that's when, you know, you see it in the middle. It's more about you see it in the middle of the fairway, and now it's in a divot. So you're in shock that it's in a divot. So you play all these four me's versus saying, okay, what do I need to do? And then immediately going into strategy and tactics of what this shot takes, what do I know how to do, and get on with it. And so you don't stay in the emotion of the situation. You immediately get out of the emotion, and then you go into strategy and tactics, take a little mental vacation, figure out what you're going to do, and then pop in and hit the shot. So the quicker you take the emotion out and get into strategy, the faster you'll be. And other than that, just suck it up.
I can't think of a better answer than that. That's a great answer. Thank you. Brian, let's get in a little more specific technical side of it, if we will. How does I'm not criticizing Penny. That is a great way. You do need to suck it up, but I think Dale wants to get a little bit of an example of how to set up for a shot like that. Is there anything different he needs to do? So Brian, let's start off. As I said, Dale's hit it into Clint's divot. So let's see how how we would advise Dale to hit this shot.
All right. Well, the first thing is attitude. You know, instead of feeling bad about it, try to make it an opportunity to say, "Hey, I'm not going to let this get to me." And your attitude before the shot's really going to dictate it. From that, technique-wise, what I like to do when I'm in a divot, I'll put a lot more weight on my left side. I'll take extra club so I can make a more a compact swing, knowing I have enough distance, and just try to pick it out of there, a little bit more weight forward, try to get your hands forward, try to trap it out of that divot. And it might come out a little hotter, it might not spin as much, but if you go at it with a good attitude, that's half the battle right there, saying, you know, I can get it out of there. And, you know, just change your setup a little bit. More weight left, more hands left, and maybe the ball back a little in your stance just to get a little bit more descending blow out of it.
Very good. Clint, your ears are probably burning because Dale's hit his golf ball.
Okay. I'm sorry for him, but... You know, I'm gonna come in there as a combo of what that was just said. I think you gotta look at it, step away from it, kind of blow the steam out your ears, and then take a deep breath and determine, from a technical standpoint, the way I've always done it, is to look at the situation I'm dealing with, and position my body and the club in such a way that I can come as close as possible to catching the ball first. You know, if the ball's sitting in the back of the divot, maybe not, you know, what I've got to do to catch it first out of the back of the divot. It's in the front of the divot, maybe caught up in the, you know, the deeper part of that divot. Then I got to figure out how to catch that ball first and drive it on through there. So I've always just tried to, like, take an extra club, choke down on it, try to get, you know, just to try to catch that ball first. And body position is going to be dictated by how the ball is lying in the divot.
Right, exactly. Very well said. And just to add it, I guess, just to sort of summarize up, Dale, I agree with Penny. I think you have to suck it up. I look at it this way. When we are faced with something like this, I don't look at it as a negative. I look at it as each shot's a new challenge. And I want to try and figure out how I'm going to challenge my, you know, how I'm going to handle that challenge, because that builds, I think, your playing ability. I think the more that you're challenged, I mean, think about it this way for a second, guys. If you're going out on a golf course and every single shot was the same, perfectly flat lie, you know, there was no undulation in the greens, and every shot was exactly the same, just a different club, golf would be extremely boring. So, you know, it's great that we have these different scenarios. You have side hill lies, uphill, downhill, you know, deep bunkers, shallow bunkers. You know, you've got a myriad of different scenarios. And that's what makes golf such an interesting game, is you're never faced with the same shot every time. You might have similar shots, but they're never exactly the same. Sometimes your ball might be a little, you know, buried a little further in a bunker than it was the last time you were in the bunker. So this is what makes it interesting. And I think as far as this particular shot goes, Dale, I think the easiest way that I would express it to you is take one less club. Again, depending on the scenario, but I would take one less club for the shot. And obviously the shaft is going to lean a little more forward by playing the ball back in your stance a little further than normal. So that's going to certainly deal off the club a little bit, so you can afford to take a one less club. And in your backswing, you want to hinge your hands a little quicker in order to create a steeper angle of attack, because you want to make sure that you're making good contact with the ball and not you know, hitting the side of the divot or something to that effect that's going to you know, affect your shot. And finally, as Clint sort of alluded to in the downswing, you know, you want to follow through as best you can. But the one thing, too, that you want to be careful of is because even though you're hinging your hands maybe a little faster in the backswing, you want to be careful that you don't unhinge them too quickly in the downswing and end up coming in behind the ball too much and, you know, end up creating another divot behind the ball. And that often happens a lot. But really, you have to address it as a new challenge and don't let it, you know, bog you down and really don't worry about it. Just go out there and have fun in the game and enjoy it and you know, get even with Clint some other way. You know, if you see him somewhere yeah. And just, you know, let him know that next time fill that hole in the middle of the fairway. Guys, that sort of, you know, ends the round of questions. But if you've all got a few more minutes, I would like to I wasn't going to do this, but I want to Penny brought up something very interesting earlier about women and golf and things like that, and I read a very interesting article, and I'm going to talk about it much in more depth on a later broadcast, but I wanted to just sort of throw a seed out there, if you will. This was an article that was done by Stina Sternberg from Golf Digest, and she written an article, and I won't read the whole thing because it's fairly long, but it was entitled The Female Factor, Lessons We Can Learn from Countries with High Percentages of Women Golfers. And really what it talks about in the article is proportionately female golfers, and I'm just going to give you some of the different countries, starting with South Africa, roughly all of the golfers, of all the golfers in South Africa, 10% are women. Then you move on to Scotland, England, roughly 16, 17%, Japan is 20%, and of course in the U.S. here, 20% of all golfers out there are female. So of roughly 25 or so million golfers, about 5 million are female. Canada is 30%, and of course, interestingly enough, there are about five countries that are well above that 20%, Canada being one, of course, Sweden, Netherlands, Switzerland, and Korea, and of course, Germany tops at 39%. And there's a lot of different reasons that she indicates here in the article, and I think it's worth having a good lengthy discussion sometime. As I said, we're not going to get into it tonight here because I know you guys don't have the time, but I just like to go around the panel here and just get some thoughts. Some of the things that need to be changed in the industry in order to encourage and get more women to play golf and get them, you know, out there, because I think it's going to make a difference. As we all know, Less rounds are being played every year. The stats don't lie. I've read it several times out here on Golf Talk Live. Roughly about 4.5 to 5% of the number of rounds played per year in the United States has decreased since 2006, and it's not all related to the economy. And I think one of the things is getting more juniors involved, obviously, but also I think getting more women engaged. So, Brian, I'm going to throw you under the bus this time. Brian, just your thoughts. What are some things that we can do in the industry and society in general to really encourage more women to play and make it easier for them to play? Some thoughts there, if you will.
Well, I think at the junior level, I'll start right there, is, you know, more education on how golf's a lifetime sport that can be enjoyed forever for somebody's career. And I think nothing against all these other sports kids are playing. I think it's all great, but golf is just there forever. And I'd start with some education there. The other thing, for beginning golfers, I think there's too many rules involved with it. I think women should just play from their comfort level. It might not be a certain set of tees or whatever. Their comfort zone might be the 150-yard marker, and there's nothing wrong with that. Just to get them out on the golf course and maybe just play 5 holes or 3 holes. You know, you don't have to play 9 or 18, and you don't have to play from the ladies' tee. Just go out and have fun. Used to being at a golf course and being with your friends, and if it's only for an hour, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. And if it's from the 150-yard marker, there's nothing wrong with that either. Just go out and have some fun and try to develop your game and take it from there. I think the rules we have in golf restrict a lot of play, and I think something like that would help.
Good point. Those excellent points. Thank you, Brian. Penny, I'm going to leave you to last because I want to read something out here. Brian touched a little bit about it, but Clint, I'm going to let you go next. What are some things that we can do in the industry? And let me just say this first before I let you respond.
Sure.
I feel very strongly about this, and this is one of the reasons why I've started a second program called the Women of Golf that I co-host with Cindy Miller. And because I think it's a market that needs to be aggressively pursued, and I think in a positive way, not as Penny alluded to earlier, we don't need all the snake oil salesmen out there trying to sell women a bill of goods. We need to get out there and really educate them about how to play this game properly and how they can enjoy it and have fun and also use it for as a business tool as well and for those that are in the executive world. But what are some things that you feel that we need to do in general in the industry to make it more inviting and to be able to encourage more women to come out and play?
You know, it's really kind of a societal issue, industry issue, combo type thing that we're looking at. You know, it's almost like it's a rite of passage for a father to take his son to the golf course because, you know, I'm going to go hunting, I'm going to go fishing, now we're going to go to the country club or the golf club and play golf. And it's just expected type thing. You know, now I'm a father of 2 daughters, and one of my daughters mm-hmm. plays golf and the other one plays at it, which is, you know, but so personalities play involved there to get other things going on. But, you know, it's really interesting, and Peggy, I'm really happy that you're going last here because I think your insight here is going to be phenomenal. My wife, when we first got married, she started playing golf. She thought everybody played like I did. You know, I made her go out and play. I made her go play with the ladies group one afternoon, and she came back in the shop and says, "Man, they don't play no better than I do." So there's that comfort level that the girls, particularly now, you're seeing more girls playing golf now than you have in the past because the athletes are coming into the golf arena now. They're not playing basketball or softball in high school. Girls golf in our area here is literally exploding at the high school level, okay? I mean, for a number of years, the high schools around us, nobody had girls' teams. The girls played on the boys' team. Well, they don't have that anymore except for one high school now. They all have the girls' team. I mean, that's a phenomenal growth over the past 10 years of the number of high school girls playing golf here. And I don't know if that's happening across the country, across the state, but right here in this area, girls' high school golf is exploding, and that's a wonderful thing. But, you know, the thing, I know just recently, I'm, like a lot of other people, are Facebook friends with Carol Mann.
Mm-hmm.
And she was on this about the first major is not the Masters. The
right.
The first major golf event in the golf industry is on the LPGA Tour.
Yep.
Okay. If we're going to get girls more involved, they need to see girls playing golf on television, on the media, whatever they're doing. They're not seeing that.
Mm-hmm.
They only see the guys playing. Every weekend, now
yeah.
I'm biased, obviously, every weekend there's a men's golf tournament on television. So
mm-hmm.
what does the girl see? They see the guys playing. Girl's not playing.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of that needs to take place in the industry. And this is the problem with the LPGA that have to work, too. And I know they're fighting for it. The exposure
right.
they get, just like the exposure we got back in the 60s and 70s with the PGA Tour on television, okay, that
mm-hmm.
exposure will have a major effect in the culture of the people sitting in the living rooms watching that show.
Right, and that is an excellent point. And, you know, even though there are certainly LPGA events televised and that it sort of piggybacks the men's tours, the men certainly get a priority in ratings and network coverage. And, you know, I understand there's a lot of money involved there, but and that's, you know, number one reason why they're getting it. But, Penny, I want to bring in you in here. But before I do, Penny, I want to read something here, and bear with me here. This is just something that Stina had in her article here, and I think it's important because it touched on a little bit about what Brian started to say. And this little segment is the buck stops here. And what the article goes on to say is the majority of countries that do well with women golfers have an overriding agency or federation that's responsible for the sport and its national growth. In some cases, it's a government-recognized entity with the funding from the nation's Olympic Committee, but not always necessarily. What these agencies or national federations have in common is that the golfers contribute to them financially when they register to play or become members of a golf club. In many of these countries, even public golfers are required to register with the federation through the club or course at which they play. The registration fees are small. In Holland, as an example, it's equivalent of about $20 per adult golfer per year. In Sweden, it's $25, so on and so forth. And then they refer to, in Canada, golf is governed by Golf Canada, which reports to a federal agency called Sport Canada, and they have to fill certain mandates to remain part of that family and retain funding. Now, I don't want to suggest that, you know, that especially in this political climate, that the government needs to step in, but I want to read on because this is really the important part here. Sport Canada considers women an underserved part of the golf population. Even at 30% of golfers in Canada are female, so Golf Canada goes after women market in a big way. Golf Canada has data that shows if girls aren't exposed to a sport like golf between the ages of 6 and 12, the chances of their picking up that sport later drop significantly. Hence, a prime focus for Golf Canada is to reach young ladies early, which they do through public schools. So far, the golf in school programs is in 2,100 elementary schools and over 200 high schools in Canada, and they're hoping to bring it to all 14,000 plus such schools in the coming years. The funding for this comes from Golf Canada, who gets part of its money from member dues, i.e. the Canadian golfers, as part from the government. So my question to you, Penny, is this. In light of some of that information, some of that data, the number one thing that I can see is that we need to get golf back in the communities, not just at the golf courses, but into the school systems, and treat it as much like many of the other sports. Now, some schools I know have teams, and Clint, you alluded to out in the Carolinas there, I know that golf is really booming in that. But there are a lot of other areas around this country where they don't have an effective golf program. And I think that the younger that we get some of these, particularly these young ladies, involved and introduced to the sport, the more likely they're going to want to play it as they age and mature, whereas as trying to get them later on in life and introduce them to the game is a much harder beast, if you will. So in your mind, is what she's saying in this article, is that should be a priority, is getting it back into the school system, and is that one of the things that they need to do here, I think?
Well, first of all, you must send me that link. I've got to read that. I have not read that. That's a wonderful wonderful piece. So really what you're talking about is, what is the business plan for golf for women in the United States of America? The United States of America is very different from Canada. I'm originally from Australia, which has more of a social bent to it. And in Canada, where they have, it's a lot easier for women in Australia and Canada to make headway. They don't have that tough of a haul. So, but we have a very different animal in this country. So the tactics and strategies as women, you have to understand, there's a couple of things here, because it all comes down to money. Money is power. And so we all know that. It doesn't matter what gender it is. Money is power. And so the guys get paid to be on TV. We pay to be on TV. You'll see the PGA. We were there in January. We had this amazing dinner. They must have spent $150,000 for this dinner. And we had small hors d'oeuvres when we had our meeting together. So money is power. So what are we doing as women to continue to bring women into the game? Because, you know, it's really important for family reasons, for many, many reasons. We're really taking a whole different attack. The LPGA Girls Golf Club has been growing incredibly every year, and I forget the numbers now that Mike One was saying to us in January, but we've got like 40,000, and they're looking to have another 40,000 by the end of the year, and I think that's having an impact. We are also looking at, and as I'm more in business today than anything else, we started at Women Owning the Game of Business Golf. And what we're looking to do here is, we are wanting more women, of course, in the boardrooms that make those power decisions, and the CEOs, so that they can effectively push money through into the golf world for women. So we're attacking it from many different areas so that we can have more voice. And we have the same issues in the business world for women as we have in the golf industry. So we believe that golf is, and we all guys, we all know this because we've done it our whole lives, that golf is the global business tool. So by training women how to use golf as a business tool, and then training them how the mindset of golf is equivalent to the mindset in business, and then we really have a great product. And then as they continue on, and there's some wonderful testimonials of women that have wonderful business connections built through playing golf. So we have initiatives going in that area. Media is still very male-dominated for us to break into that. It takes shows like yours, Ted, bringing in excellent speakers on women's subjects that understand it. And education. Education is big. I mean, that would be a part of the business plan for golf for women. And then it's at a local level at a golf courses, you know, having kid care, having... I grew up in Australia playing boys and girls all together. We always played together. And in this country, it disappoints me. It makes me so sad that the boys and girls aren't growing up together playing the game of golf, because the more we grow together, then the more we're used to seeing each other the same. And I've never known a golf ball to say, well, you're female or you're male, so therefore you should have more rights, you know. And we so that culturally as a nation in our golf world, bringing the genders together more at a junior age would be another portion of the business plan as I see it. And understanding that we as women have different needs and different desires and different wants. That we have a model set up for competition, you know, and the guys go out and talk, which is great on a Saturday, or we can get away from the family. You know, guys just love to shoot the breeze about nothing and have a great time, and who cares? And that's what they do. Women, you know, a few halls, got the kids, you got the family, you got all this stuff. So we just have a whole different reason why we want to play golf. Many, many times.
Right.
Not, and again, you know, we have our serious golfers like in that way. So just having many more choices for women and how they want to play golf would be great. And we've already talked about the fact that we have some amazing women golf course architects today, that they have more voice in putting the tees in. Jan Beljan, who is the PGA Show, again, brilliant speaker on the subject. And so you have to have her on your show, Ted. I mean, which is wonderful. And so just getting a lot of women that have turned, moved from golf and have passion, and I love golf, I will love golf till the day I die, and using our business skill set to help motivate and bring forward the game of golf for women in this country. So I think that's more of a U.S. way. We're very entrepreneurial. We're not waiting. You know, I would love it to say, okay, my country, you give us this money and everything else. But that's not America, man. We're home and brave, and we're flash, swashbuckling entrepreneurs, and I'm a crazy, I'm a serial entrepreneur. So, you know, it is what it is. It's up to women to decide how we choose to move forward. And that's the change that's happening. I mean, the guys get out and play more golf, right? So the women need to find ways to do it, but we have to inspire them. And that's women talking to women, and then having our male guys that love the women too, and being appropriate. And so it's a woman's problem. It's not a male problem. It's not a PGA problem. It's a woman problem. And women that love the game are doing so much behind the scenes to grow it. And then we need strong women in business to move the money in the direction we need. It takes a lot of money to change something. And that's where we are lacking in the decision makers getting us the money. And when we change that needle, we will change the game of golf. And that's what we're doing.
Yeah, and I agree. That's a great comments, Penny, and that was one of the reasons I wanted to sort of bring that into the panel tonight. I decided to do that kind of last minute, but since I knew you had you on the program, I knew that you're very involved in doing that. Let me just ask one final thing along this lines, and this has been posed to me. This question has been posed to me in the past a number of times, and actually quite recently. Do you think it would impact women's golf? I believe it would in a positive way if there was a women's masters tournament at Augusta National.
Well, I just don't think it's for women. I think it's for the world. This is the premier event, and you are showing so much prejudice. I mean, I'm so grateful that our first woman that became a member was black, female. Hello. How many people are turning in their grave just on that one? It's big. It's this is not a woman problem. This is a problem with the overall arching idea that they're really saying, hey, you know what? Women don't belong. And until Augusta or the great names in, the Royal and Ancient, all of the people, in the end of the day, decisions are made in big places. And in the big places, it's not you and I, it's not us, the pros. We're doing what we can do. It's the decision makers. The decision makers are not on the side of growing the game. And growing the game, if we move the needle by 20% to have more families and women on the golf course, that's a lot. That's billions of dollars. You bring that story to them, and maybe Augusta might change its mind.
Right. And one of the things that I've talked about briefly on this program a while back with some others that were on the panel, the golf industry, of course, is a billion-dollar industry, and it's grown leaps and bounds in the last decade or so. But a majority of that money is staying at the professional level, and it's not sort of trickling down into what I look at it this way. I compare the golf industry to the banking industry. The golfing industry or the banking industry, for instance, you've got your top banks and financial institutions and sort of large portfolios and investments, and then you've got your frontline bankers and your tellers and so forth, and they're really the people that are dealing with the customers. Much like in golf, you've got your touring professionals that are sort of at the top of the golf game, and of course your manufacturers and so forth, and then you've got your teach professionals who really are dealing with the average golfer out there on a day in day out basis. And I think that by shifting some of that money that's coming in the golf industry back into programs that are going to embrace some of the things that you just talked about, Penny, and some of the things, Clint, that you mentioned earlier, and Brian as well, I think is going to help grow this game because, you know, like we talked about a little while ago, mentioning about some of the gadgets and the equipment, that's not helping growing the game. That's just simply moving product, and I'm not trying to knock business. I mean, I think it's I'm all for entrepreneurship, but at the same time, if it's not truly helping the game and it's just simply flogging a product, then what good, what purpose does it really serve? And I think that the money could be better spent and the direction could be focused a little differently. And like you said, if we can move that needle even 20%, we're talking billions of dollars that would come back in, and also it would encompass you know, families being more involved. I mean, think about this for a second. You know, if you go back about 15 years ago, Las Vegas, as an example, and I said this last week on the program, they changed their model, if you will, from to the traditional gamblers to more family-friendly, and they had a huge boom and surge in Las Vegas. Well, now they've kind of gone back and changed it back to a different format again. And if the golf industry would do that and make it more family-friendly and encourage more women to play and more kids to play, and husbands to be engaged in a family environment, that doesn't mean the guys can't go and play with their, you know, weekend foursome still. But I think if they did that, if the industry focused more on that, I think they would see a huge surge in the golf industry. Do agree or disagree or what, Clint?
Well, you know, you make the analogies, a number of them there. I mean, from a PGA, member of the PGA for over 30 years and been out here either working for country clubs or owning my own facilities, we're the stakeholder. We're the person, you know, we're on the ground. We're the foot soldier out there trying to grow the game. And we, over the past few years, have gotten a lot of lip service out of our organization nationally. You know, with these over-the-top programs, you know, the Get Golf Readies and the this program and that program. It seems like they just keep throwing programs against the wall to see which one sticks. The problem of it is that me as a golf professional, they want me to get involved in Get Golf Ready and give five lessons for $100.
Yeah.
You know, I can't make a living doing that.
Right.
So what do I do? I have to prioritize, maybe do a little bit of that. So it's almost like it's charity work to grow the game. It's going to be, you know, you're betting on the come a little bit, which I understand that. But, you know, after a while, I mean, there has to be some support there other than, hey, we're just going to throw out some pamphlets and do a little TV show. And guess what? You're going to be out there in the middle of the summer and it's 90 degrees and you're giving lessons for $100 for $20 an hour. You know, and so there's some of that going on, but two, I mean, there's a number of things that was said here that is a cultural issue versus just a golf issue. I'm not, you know, maybe I'm just old school here, but I sure like the Masters, the tournament, the way it is. Now, what they do with Augusta National membership, I think that's the membership's decision to make, and whoever they want to invite, they can invite. Okay, because we have to be careful if we like the institutions that we're members of and we're part of that membership and we decide who the members of this club is going to be and that club is going to be, we have to be respectful for other people that have the same matter of choices. And so just because, you know, the Augusta National now, and I was really proud it was Condoleezza Rice because she's a hero of mine. I respect her and her class and how she carries herself is wonderful. But we also have to be careful that if we have institutions that are all female institutions versus all males, we can't think that we ought to be members of every group, but we want to keep ours over here sanctum. So, I mean, those are things we have to be careful of within our industry that we're not asking for something that may come back to haunt us in the future. But as far as the women playing golf, I think it is a responsibility, as Penny brought, is that, hey, if you want to get involved, go out there and get involved. I mean, that we can't – it's that old horse-to-water thing. You can lead them as much as you want to, but you just can't make them participate. They have to want to themselves. But we also, from an industry standpoint, have to make it – I think one of the things that I've seen very successful is child care. Hey, we got a little nursery here. You know, we'll watch, you know, if you want to come out and practice, you want to get better, because obviously we all know the better you play, the more fun you're having, the longer you're going to do it.
Right.
And, you know, we used to have, years ago, we don't have it now in different facilities, kind of the mom's morning out program.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, hey, come out in the morning. We got daycare for your kids. You know, it was a chance for mom to go out and play a few holes or hit some practice balls, or there was always an instructor available that could help you with it a little bit. But we had the young mother that would come out and play. You know, when I first got into this business, the family was a member. The majority of the female members of the club didn't work. You know, that was just societal issues. And so they had time to be more active at the club. You know, you don't see that now. Okay? So time constraints has a big play on Penny.
Right.
You just tell me, Penny, please tell me to shut up anytime you feel like it, okay?
No, baby, you're doing real good. I'm loving what you're saying right now.
Okay, you just tell me to
you
shut
keep
up.
Keep it going now. I'm loving it.
Okay.
Yeah,
so
let,
you
let
tell
me
to shut up anytime.
Yeah, Clint, I'm gonna just for a second here. Let me just clarify something. I want to make sure, because I think there might have been a misunderstanding what I meant about Augusta National. I don't think that they should change the existing tournament and include women in the Masters tournament per se.
Right.
That's not what I was getting at. What I was getting at is I think that if the women's had their own Masters tournament,
I think that'd be great.
You know, that's what I'm talking. Yeah. I think that they should keep. You know, and it's not to separate anything, but I think I don't think they should change the existing format. What I'm saying
right.
is, I think that if Augusta, as an example, said, okay, wait a minute, here's a potential for us to, kind of not take advantage, it's a bad way to put it, but do something to really tap into a market that it has not been tapped into. We're going to open up our facility as we do. Once a year for the men, to the ladies now, to the professional lady golfers out there, and have a female Masters tournament, because I think it would do two things. First off, it would certainly add to the brand, the positive brand that's already out there, but also, too, I think that it would send a message to the rest of the ladies out there that don't play golf saying, you know what, this is a pretty prestigious tournament. This is exciting. There's something for us. The same caliber as the Masters. And I think it would ignite a fire and get a lot of women, just like when Tiger came out on the tour, how many youngsters come out there and wanted to be the next Tiger Woods. He set a fire in the industry, really. And I think that it's getting time now. But, yeah, I don't think that, courses and whatnot need to do what they feel best for their facilities. I'm not suggesting that it needs to change that way if they choose not to. That's up to them how they choose to proceed. But I think it would be good for golf in general if the ladies had their own Augusta Masters tournament.
Oh, yeah,
because
I
think
agree
it would
with that
care.
For sure. I mean,
yeah,
you think
that's
about
what
the,
I meant. And,
yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, I mean,
The two greatest institutions in golf today, the USGA and the Rolling Ancient, both have the equal championships for men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So why shouldn't Augusta?
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was getting at. And I think that's something that, again, taking what Penny was saying earlier, that's something that's going to have to come from within the women themselves. They're going to have to be the ones to push that. And one of the ways to do that is, again, getting them more of the corporate level and getting that money that's there, those corporate dollars, and go over to be able to accomplish some of these things. But I just think that there's a lot, and this is something that I want to do with the other program I have, Women of Golf, that Cindy and I are working on together. And this is something that we're going to get into a lot more detail and discussion as time goes on. But I just wanted to kind of throw it out there, and I actually went longer than I thought I was going to go with this topic. But and Brian, I gave you a little bit of a rest there, a little bit of a break. But if you have any thoughts or comments you want to add before we wrap up here, please do so. Well, I'm assuming Brian's still here. Brian? No, I think we might have lost him. Anyways, he might have run for the hills here. Oh,
we ran him off, Clint. We ran him off.
Yeah, we run him out. Didn't we? Well, I can do that. Ted can attest to it. I can run you right on out of here.
Ted, I am here. Can you hear me? Ted.
Yeah, I can now.
All right. Now, Ted, I'll tell you what. Listening to Penny and Clint is an education for me. Great stuff out of them. I enjoy listening as much as I enjoy participating in the answers. This is fantastic. In closing for me, Ted, is that what you're asking? You want me to?
Yeah, if you have some thoughts on what we've been talking about, if you want to add to it, and if you feel that we've pretty much covered everything, that's fine. I'll let you bow out gracefully. And I'm going to give you guys a couple of minutes each if you want to. Actually, let's do that because I think we have – I really want to have this discussion, a little bit more in detail, and I want to get some other ladies involved as well in this. But Brian, why don't we do this? Why don't you just let the listeners know how they can get a hold of you and that, and if there's anything specific that you're working on that you want to make aware of, by all means, you go ahead, and we'll start off with you and then Penny and then Clint.
Sure. For number one, Ted, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And Clint, we've spoken before. I love listening to your stuff. You're awesome. And Penny, we started a new relationship tonight. I know who you are. I've never had the opportunity to speak with you, and I thought you were just fantastic. So hats off to both of you. It was a pleasure joining you. Ted, if for your listeners out there, and specifically ones in New Jersey, if anybody wants to reach me, they can reach me at Montclair Golf Club. We're in West Orange. My email address is briandobbypga@yahoo.com. That's the best way to get in touch with me. And for the New Jersey listeners, I want to throw a little bit to the – tell you about what's going on with the New Jersey Golf Foundation. It's a great organization here in New Jersey. They've got some great golf and school programs. They do a lot with the veterans, with the New Hope program, and our big classic is August 4th at the famous Baltus Royal Golf Club. If anybody wants to play in that, they can go to the New Jersey Golf Foundation website and get information on that. It's a great day at a great golf course, and it's for a great cause. So, Ted, again, thanks for having me on, and it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome, Brian, and always a pleasure to have you on as well. And you have an open invitation, as the others do as well, that you're welcome to come back anytime. And if you haven't jumped on the schedule, take a look at the schedule, and if there's any future dates that you want to come back, I'm more than happy to have you there. And Brian, just one other thing. You wanted to mention something. You had sent me an email before. There was one other thing that you wanted to mention while you were on here.
We could talk about that another time. I want to go over that with you, but we'll do that another time. I appreciate it.
Okay, not a problem. Penny, I'm going to let you go next. If you want to let the listeners out there, if there's anything specific that you want to make them aware of or talk about for a minute or two.
Well, thank you, Ted, very much. It's been a delight to be on the show. Been a hoot with the guys, love it. But my book, Focus Determines Success, An Athletic Approach to Achieving More, that book was written on my pre, in, and post golf swing, and we were talking so much on the mental side of the game, and that really gives you a snapshot of the structures that you need and how you manage your focus to do that, to execute in those 10 seconds. And I also, you can reach me at pennypulz, P-U-L-Z, as in zebra.com. And today my main work is I teach a lot of strategies and tactics of thinking to manage your focus on demand. And I do that in business, and I do it in athletics, besides in golf and other sports. So it's really great to teach what people have thought of as a high-level training and broke it down. I've been studying for 25 years, break it down in simple terms because that's what golf is about and that's what I've been trained in, and to help people to manage their focus on demand and not get themselves all out of stead. So you can reach me through pennypulz.com. And again, thank you so much, Ted. It's been an absolute delight.
Well, I appreciate it, Penny. It was an honor to have you back on the program. As I mentioned at the beginning, you were on here once before as a separate guest, but I'm glad to have you on the panel, and I hope you come back on again for future panels when your schedule permits. We'd love to have you back. I appreciate your thoughts and your input. And certainly last but not least, Clint, I haven't forgotten you. Clint, if you want to take a minute or two and just let the listeners out there know how they can get a hold of you and you're working on right now.
No problem, Ted. Again, you know, here my ego is exploding here. I can't stand all this nice stuff, you know. But it has been quite a pleasure, as always has been. Everybody's out there knows they can get a hold of me at it's tgmgoff.com, or they can give me my email is clintgoff001@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from anybody out there that wants to either drag me through the coals or pump my ego up. Either way, it'd be, you know me, I'd talk to you all day long if I could. But, Penny, I'd really like to – Brian and I have talked a couple of times afterwards in email. I'd really like to talk to you a little bit about your focus program. I think that's very intriguing to me, and we talk a lot about in the R3 Academy how you change that focus from practice to play and from shot to shot. I'd really like to have a conversation with you a little bit, hopefully in the near future, about that. It's something that intrigues me a lot, and because – you know, we all know that once you can hit it, it's all about how you try. So, but again, it's been a pleasure. Mm-hmm. It's been great, Ted. You know, anytime you need me to come on here and rant and rave with you, I'm always available.
Well, I appreciate it, and it was a great panel discussion, and I enjoy it, and thank you for helping the listeners out there and shedding the light and sharing some great insight. And of course, Penny, we certainly appreciate your not only your teaching aspect, but also as a professional athlete and a professional player from the LPGA Tour. Your insight to the game is certainly added to the discussion tonight. We certainly appreciate that. And Brian, of course, always we'll have you guys back on again, I'm sure. But Brian, thank you as well. Always a pleasure to have you on the program. And thank you for also referring some folks to me as well that have expressed interest about the program. So I appreciate that as well, Brian. But, guys, thank you very much for participating tonight. You have a great, great evening. And thank you for coming on Coach's Corner tonight.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thank
you. Bye-bye.
You're welcome. Okay, that's going to wrap up the program. Just want to very quickly, again, thank my guest panel tonight, Brian Dobby, the PGA teacher professional at the Montclair Golf Club, and website there is www.montclairgolfclub.org. You can certainly learn more about the facility there, and you can get a hold of Brian through that website as well. And obviously, Penny Pauls, a great LPGA professional, and she was a two-time LPGA champion and was ranked number 10 golfer in the world with an 18-year career. Does a lot of great things. She's written books and does a lot of things to help develop golf and all around the world, but particularly for women. And if you want to learn a little bit more about Penny Pauls and what she's all about and get in touch with her, you can certainly do so at her website at Penny Pauls, that's P-U-L-Z, like zebra, .com. And, of course, my main man, Mr. Clint Wright, PGA teacher professional for over 30 years at R3 Golf Academy, up there in the Carolinas, and you can get a hold of him at his website at www.tgmgolf.com. Thanks again, guys, for coming on Golf Talk Live, and I just want to thank all of you out there from around the world that tune into the program each and every week. I want to thank you for your continued support. I want a special thank you to some of the sponsors and supporters of the show, Mr. Jonathan Laird, of course, of South Coast Golf Guide. He's been a great supporter, and you can see the advertisement, his publication there, South Coast Golf Guide, at one of your local courses here in the Southeast. And if you want to get in touch with Jonathan about advertising in the magazine, you can do so at jonathan@southcoastgolfguide.com. And, of course, Meredith Kirk of Meredith Kirk Golf and the Endless Golf Myrtle Beach magazine. She also involved with that. And also she was the 2014 Mrs. South Carolina. And she's going on this August to go for the title of Mrs. USA sometime in Mrs. America, I believe it is actually, in August of this year. She's going to try for the crown. And, of course, Nikki and Tiffany Litherland from Down Under, who are making their way back over here to the U.S., thank you for spreading the word about the show, and I appreciate that. And, of course, Mr. Bernie Pinder of Ontic Golf, the founder and president and CEO of Ontic Golf, a great line of custom putters. And, of course, Mr. Peter Doyle over in Ireland, my good friend over there, Doyle Golf Solutions. I want to thank again the guest panel tonight, Mr. Brian Dobby, Penny Pauls, and Clint Wright. Thanks, guys, for stopping by. Just a reminder, this coming Tuesday, don't forget to join Cindy Miller and I on the Women of Golf. That's every Tuesday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time on blogtalkradio.com. Just go up in the search button and type Women of Golf, and you'll get directly to our show. Have a great weekend, everybody, and I will see you back here next Thursday at 6 p.m. right here on Talk Live. Thanks, everybody, and have a great evening.